Well-being has an interesting historical trajectory, beginning with the Greek pursuit of eudaimonia, which literally translated means spirit of well-being, through more recent philosophising about utilitarianism in the 19th century. The recent rediscovery of well-being reflects developing concerns within the field of public health, where the distinction between illness, health and well-being emerged as part of a critique of medical worldviews and the developing practice of health promotion. But well-being isn't limited to health, and recent definitions have highlighted a number of other spheres of life where it can be found, including social, career, financial and community well-being. Generic definitions, however, have highlighted two key domains at the level of the individual: feeling good and functioning well. So, for example, on their website, the New Economics Foundation state that feelings of happiness, contentment, enjoyment, curiosity and engagement are characteristic of someone who has a positive experience of their life. They also suggest, however, that equally important for well-being is our functioning in the world, experiencing positive relationships, having some control over one's life and having a sense of purpose are all important attributes of well-being. Much of the focus to date in terms of our understanding about the factors that contribute to well-being emphasise what we need to do in the here and now to improve it. What I want to do in the course of this lecture is to suggest that our capacity for well-being in the here and now, and defined very broadly in terms of the earlier definition of feeling good and functioning well, is significantly influenced by our experiences during childhood, and more specifically by what is referred to as our primary intersubjective experiences, which occur during the first year of life. Although there has been considerable debate over the years about the relative importance of nature in terms of our genes and nurture in terms of the early environment, it is now pretty well accepted that both play a significant role in the individual's development. For example, in terms of the heritability of particular traits or characteristics, it is now recognised that the portion that is explicitly due to genetic factors in most cases is less than 50%. This means that the remaining variance is due to the environment. Behavioural geneticists refer to two aspects of the environment, the shared and the non-shared. The former refer to environmental factors that make siblings in a family alike, and the latter to factors that make them unique. Together, these two categories cover most aspects of the environment, ranging from very early life experiences in the womb and during the early years, through to the influence of peer groups, school, and the wider socio-political and cultural environment. Bronfenbrenner captures the nature of these influences very nicely in his ecological systems theory, which refers to a number of spheres of influence on the individual, ranging from the micro through to the meso and exosystem, and finally to the macro system. Having acknowledged that children's development is influenced by a wide range of factors, I want to focus on one particular aspect of the environment that has over the past decade come to be recognised as playing a particularly significant role throughout childhood. Research now shows that one of the most enduring influences on the way in which a child develops is the parenting that they receive. Before I go any further, however, I want to make clear that parenting does not take place in a vacuum and is influenced by a wide range of both social and cultural factors. Back in 1984, Belsky developed a process model to depict the key determinants of parenting, and he highlighted three sets of factors: the parent's own development and personality, social factors such as work, social support and marital relations, and finally the characteristics of the child. This model was developed in the 1980s, and I don't doubt that we could now add other factors into the equation, including cultural and religious, but the basic premise underpinning the model still pertains. We now know from both longitudinal and secondary data analysis that a range of aspects of parenting are important. These are characterised by what has been defined as authoritative parenting, which involves a combination of love and nurturance, with positive discipline and firm boundaries. However, Research also suggests that the parenting a child receives during the first year of life is actually foundational to everything that follows, and that the parenting needs of an infant during this period are quite unique. In order to demonstrate this, we actually need to examine the developmental trajectory between the parent-infant relationship and later well-being. Briefly stated, the research shows that specific aspects of the relationship between parent and infant that we call primary intersubjective experiences create the conditions that are necessary for the infant to develop a sense of themselves as secure and lovable, to the child's awareness of themselves and other people as having a mind, with the related capacity for understanding that behaviours are underpinned by beliefs and intentions, and also for symbolic functioning. Deficiencies in any of these areas will have a deleterious impact on the child's developing sense of who they are as an individual, and in terms of their capacity for self-agency and who they might become, with significant consequences in terms of their adult capacity for what we are calling well-being. Why then is early infancy so important? The reason that the parent-infant relationship has such a big impact during this period relates to two key features of infancy. First, infants are born with very immature brains that undergo exponential amount of growth in response to the environment during the first 5 years of life, and particularly during the first 2 years. So, although the structural development of the brain is practically complete before birth, much functional development takes place during the brain's growth spurt in the first and second years of life, with a proliferation of nerve pathways conducting electrical messages across fluid-filled synapses, which rapidly increase in response to both the interpersonal and intrapersonal experiences. The infant brain overproduces synapses in response to sensory experiences and then prunes away those that are unused, leaving neurons intact and eliminating unused synapses. And this is what we mean when we say use it or lose it. Those pathways that do not become functionally established will be lost. In addition to the soft wiring of the brain, the early interactions between mother and baby play a significant role in influencing the chemical neurotransmitters that have a direct effect on the brain, thereby influencing the child's later capacity to manage stress. For example, excessive stress during infancy results in the baby's brain being flooded by cortisol for prolonged periods and an eventual lowering of the threshold for activation of fear and anxiety. This results in the child experiencing more fear or anxiety and a difficulty dampening this response. Continued high levels of stress also impact on the functioning of other parts of the body. In some instances, such as, for example, where parents are almost never emotionally available for the infant, the opposite effect can result in a flattened cortisol response. This is often found in infants who have been raised in institutional settings from birth, such as an orphanage. In her book Why Love Matters, Sue Gerhardt shows the way in which looks and smiles between parent and baby helps the baby's brain to grow by stimulating the baby's nervous system and heart rate, thereby leading to a biochemical response in the baby's brain and the release of neuropeptides, which help the growth of neurons and the formation of synapses. She talks about the way in which negative looks trigger a very different biochemical response involving the release of cortisol, and that this is detrimental in terms of the growth of the brain. The second important factor about infancy is that babies are born to relate. Indeed, they begin doing so immediately following birth. In the first 15 hours, they can distinguish their mother's voice and prefer it to a stranger's. They also prefer her smell and her face. Neonates can discriminate among surprise, fear and sadness expressions in caregivers and produce corresponding facial expressions of their own. Infants are able to detect contingencies between what they do and what the environmental response is to their actions, thereby facilitating an early sense of agency. And they also develop expectancies about how social interactions will go based on earlier experiences. Babies' exposure to emotions or affect from 10 months on influences the lateralization of their brain. So, for example, Evidence shows that babies of depressed mothers have reduced brain activity and, in particular, much lower levels of left frontal brain activity, thereby predisposing such babies to more flattened and depressive responses later in life. Early experiences of seriously suboptimal parenting, such as persistent neglect and trauma, have been shown to result in overdevelopment of the neurophysiology of the brainstem and the midbrain, and deficits in cortical functioning and limbic function. This can result to problems with anxiety, impulsivity, poor affect regulation and hyperactivity. It can also lead to difficulties with problem solving and a reduced capacity for empathy. Research shows that early disturbances in mother-child interactions are implicated in a range of longer-term adverse child cognitive and emotional outcomes, including behavioural problems. So what are the early intersubjective needs of infants? As a result of changes in the visual cortex of the infant's brain, by 2 months of age, faces have become the primary source of visuo-affective communication. One of the key neuroscientists working in the field suggests that during this period, face-to-face interactions emerge and that these are highly arousing, affect-laden, short interpersonal events that expose infants to high levels of cognitive and social information and stimulation. Alan Shaw goes on to describe the way in which babies have to regulate this with their mothers, and they do this by regulating the intensity of their interactions with one another. This is known as affect synchrony, and it involves the mother's capacity to be attuned with her baby and also to repair ruptures. Affect synchrony and repairs to ruptures are the basic building blocks with which babies begin to construct a sense of who they are and about themselves in relation to other people, and is fundamental to healthy emotional development. Parents who are experiencing mental health problems, who are abusing drugs or alcohol, or who are experiencing domestic violence, are very often less able to engage in attuned, synchronous interactions or to repair ruptures to engagement. And this has significantly deleterious effects in terms of the baby's neurological and emotional development. The process of affect synchrony has been described as follows. Attuned mutual coordination between mother and infant occurs when the infant's squeal of delight is matched by the mother's excited clapping and sparkling eyes. The baby then becomes overstimulated, arches its back and looks away from the mother. A disruption has occurred and there is a miscoordination. The mother, still excited, is leaning forward, while the baby, now serious, pulls away. However, the mother then picks up the cue and begins the repair. She stops laughing and with a little sigh quietens down. The baby comes back and makes eye contact again. Mother and baby gently smile. They are back in sync again, in attunement with one another. Key aspects of early parent-infant interaction that contribute to affect synchrony include attunement and sensitivity, marked mirroring, mentalisation and containment. Sensitivity or attunement involves the parent using eye contact, voice tone, pitch and rhythm, facial expression and touch to convey synchronicity with the infant. Marked mirroring happens when a parent shows a contingent response to an infant, such as looking sad when the baby is crying. The mirroring is marked, however, in that it is sufficiently different from the infant's expression to indicate separateness and thereby that things can be made better. Mentalisation refers to a parent's capacity to experience their baby as an intentional being with their own personality traits, strengths and sensitivities, rather than just in terms of their physical characteristics and behaviour. Containment occurs when a parent uses touch, gesture and speech to take on board the infant's powerful feelings and to make them more manageable. There is now a significant body of literature demonstrating the importance of these aspects of early development. The importance of parental sensitivity, for example, has been highlighted by a large body of attachment research. This shows that the quality of parental responses to infant cues and signals is a critical factor in the development of a secure attachment relationship and thereby also critical to the child's capacity to feel safe. Parenting that is too intrusive or too passive is detrimental to the development of attachment security. What then are the implications of these early intersubjective experiences for long-term well-being? The hypothesis of this paper has been that early intersubjective experiences within the parent-infant relationship influence later well-being because of the impact of such experiences on the soft wiring of the infant's brain and on the infant's developing capacity for emotional regulation and secure attachment, their developing theory of mind, and their capacity for mentalisation and symbolic functioning. Let us conclude then by looking at just one of these areas in which there is now an extensive body of research in terms of its implications for later well-being. John Bowlby very famously identified an important developmental point in the first year of life, which he called attachment. Attachment refers to the affective bond between infant and caregiver, and after many years of research, we now recognise it to be a highly significant component of the infant's growing capacity for self-regulation. And the research clearly shows that sensitive, emotionally responsive care during the first year is associated with secure attachment, whereas insensitive, inconsistent or unresponsive care is associated with insecure attachment. So, insecurely attached individuals have usually experienced the type of parenting in which their bids for comfort and security were either rejected or treated with an unpredictable mixture of acceptance and rejection. The research suggests that approximately one-third of children are insecurely attached, having one of two key types of insecure attachment styles called avoidant or anxious ambivalent. Avoidant children have learned that they need to down-regulate their emotions to retain closeness to the parent, and anxious ambivalent children have learned that they need to up-regulate their emotions to retain such closeness. These patterns of emotional regulation are internalised during infancy and become part of what Bowlby referred to as internal working models. Research shows that these internal working models are largely unconscious representational models of self and self with other, and they are important because they provide the child with a prototype for later relations, which continue into adulthood. In terms of the implications for later well-being, findings from a recent review of the evidence found that early attachment problems can interfere with a number of aspects of later functioning, including peer relations, intimacy, caregiving and caretaking, sexual functioning, conflict resolution, and relational aggression. For example, recent research found that attachment anxiety was related to negative affectivity, a lack of emotional clarity, non-acceptance of emotional responses, and limited access to emotional regulation strategies. Attachment avoidance was similarly related to lack of emotional awareness, lack of emotional clarity, non-acceptance of emotional responses, and limited access to emotion regulation strategies and subjective well-being. These findings suggest that adult attachment influences adult subjective well-being via the mediating influence of emotional processing and regulation, and have confirmed earlier research which showed that insecurely attached adults tended to endorse more irrational beliefs about their relationships than adults with a secure attachment style, and that this was actually related to diminished relationship satisfaction. Research on well-being in the elderly found emotional support had a bigger impact on individuals with better attachment security. Up to 80% of children experiencing severely suboptimal parenting during the early years, by which I mean emotionally abusive and neglectful relationships, develop what is called a disorganised attachment. This is strongly associated with a range of seriously adverse developmental outcomes, including social and cognitive difficulties, and a number of aspects of severe psychopathology, including personality disorder. In summary then, the evidence strongly suggests that our capacity for well-being in terms of both feeling good and functioning well begins very early on in life. I have referred to research which shows that success in the resolution of early infant developmental tasks is key to later well-being, and that early sensitive and attuned parent-infant interaction is what enables infants to achieve this. This is not to suggest that individuals who do not have optimal early experiences are incapable of later well-being, or that unmet developmental needs cannot be addressed at a later stage of development. Rather, that it can be much harder to achieve well-being if unmet developmental needs are influencing current emotions and behaviours. These findings suggest that the very early parent-infant relationship is key to enabling children to achieve their full potential in later life, and points to the importance of societies ensuring that parents receive the necessary support to enable them to provide the type of parenting that is now recognised to be important to the child's optimal development and thereby to their later well-being.